From Community Public Radio, this is the CPR News. From New York, I'm Don DeBar.
The dispute between China and the Philippines over some tiny islands in the South China Sea appears to be heating up. RT's Kevin Owen has more.
China is refusing to recognize the Hague's historic court ruling yesterday over territory in the South China Sea in favor of the Philippines. Beijing says it might now then boost its military presence in the region. Emily Susie to tell us more about this. This ruling yesterday was expected, and so was China's reaction to it. It said it wasn't going to listen to what the Hague had to say, and sure enough, that was followed through, wasn't it?
Well, yes, absolutely, Kevin. Let me take you back to the beginning. From the very beginning, when the case was first submitted to the Permanent Arbitration Court at The Hague over 3 years ago, China already dismissed it as a political farce, saying they won't recognize it, they won't accept it, and they won't enforce it. After the ruling was handed down yesterday, well, China reiterated that, but stressed that they're willing to resume dialogue with the Philippines in order to resolve this conflict. But speaking at a press conference yesterday, actually today, the Vice Foreign Minister, his tone wasn't so diplomatic. Let's take a listen.
None of the five members from the arbitration panel comes from Asia. Do they understand Asia? About the issue of the South China Sea? The five judges are paid. The Philippines paid them. Maybe some other countries also paid them. We don't know. They work for profit.
The Vice Foreign Minister, he didn't name any names, but the fact that the U.S. and the Philippines, they are treaty allies, and that the U.S. has several military bases in the Philippines, well, many analysts are suspecting that this case really is orchestrated by the U.S. in the name of their so-called diplomatic and military pivot or rebalance towards Asia. Here's how the Chinese Foreign Ministry had put it.
Before the United States adopted the rebalancing strategy, there had been some disputes in the region and some contradictions between the related countries. But on the whole, the countries in the region had been able to maintain the overall peace, stability, and security. The situation began to change only after the United States adopted the rebalancing strategy in the Asia-Pacific region.
The U.S. has denied the accusation that they have any involvement in this case. And here's the State Department's take on the ruling.
This isn't about the United States projecting moral authority. This is an international tribunal which came up with a legally binding decision that the United States didn't influence. We said before that they reached it that it would be legally binding. So did the world. Now they've reached it. It's still legally binding.
So the U.S. is happy with this result. The Philippines obviously happy with this result. China's going, hey, what result? Where's it going to go now?
Well, many are expecting both sides to step up their military game in the region, but nothing substantial has happened just yet. So far, it's only talk and flexing military muscles, if you will. But today, China reiterated that it has the right to set up an air defense zone above the South China Sea if it sees if it thinks is necessary. But they didn't go as far as saying that they will for sure. It would depend on the level of threat they face. One thing I do want to point out is that all the countries with claims in the South China Sea, they either already have or are developing military ties with the U.S. And let's not forget, Japan and South Korea are also U.S. allies. And recently, there have been numerous mass protests because people there are not happy with U.S. military deployments in those two countries. So if we take a step back and looking at the overall picture, with China effectively surrounded by pro-U.S. forces, well, the question that begs to be asked is, who really is the real threat here?
Yeah, the whole story about that question of the nine-dash line there and who owns what and who's got stake in it, it's going to be a real hot spot to watch, isn't it? Emily Sue, thank you for now.
Meanwhile, Russia's envoy to NATO had some harsh words for the U.S.-led military alliance. This was Russia's ambassador, Alexander Grushko, speaking through an interpreter at a press conference Wednesday following a special session of the so-called NATO-Russia Council.
So the main feature of today's event was that actually took place for the first time military representatives took part in the NRC meeting, and actually we had a very frank and open exchange of views. Actually, the conversation was mainly about the decisions of NATO decisions in Warsaw and their consequences for European and regional security, and most importantly, NATO activities on the eastern flank. So we think that measures on the eastern flank are not justified, they are excessive, they are counterproductive. They actually weaken the European and regional security, and they take us back to the schemes of ensuring security along the Cold War mode, so to say. Russia is not a threat to the alliance. We're not interested in the confrontational model of coexistence which has been imposed on us. And actually, this model, confrontational model, it does contradict the root interests of security of the Europeans and the very aim of forming the European security without dividing lines. And I would actually like also to say that actually it's NATO that is creating new security environment rather than is adapting to this security, to the new security environment.
Мы указали также на то, что опасность состоит и в том, что сегодня конфронтационная политика.
So actually the main danger is that the confrontational policy of NATO, which is built on the mythical threat from Russia, actually takes the shapes of concrete military planning and concrete military activities near our borders. And actually the territory of Eastern European states, which claim themselves as frontline states, is becoming a platform for military activities and for military deployments and for force projection of Russia.
Margaret Kimberly is a journalist and activist who has a weekly column at blackagendareport.com. This week's column is entitled Why We Need Black Anger. We spoke with her via Skype Thursday. Margaret, welcome back. Pleasure as always.
Thank you, Don. So this week, of course, I had to write about the recent police killings that we saw on camera of Alton Sterling and Philando Castile. This happens, of course, every day in this country. Actually, every day, three times, three people are killed by police on average every day in the United States.
Right.
And one of those people will be an African-American. And as the events unfolded, the shock of seeing Alton Sterling killed, and then 48 hours later, to see the video of Philando Castile dying, taken by his girlfriend, who, thank goodness, even in her trauma, was able to show the world what had happened to him. And then, not 48 hours later, for police to be shot in Dallas. And I witnessed this change. There was this intense rage, this intense anger from black people, mostly upon seeing what we know happens, but there's quite a difference in seeing it. And the change after the police were shot. And that's why I called my column Why We Need Black Anger, because suddenly with the death of the police in Texas, everything changed. The corporate media focused on the police. President Obama, his initial statement was very weak. It was insulting, frankly, about Sterling and Castile. This is a dastardly act, a terrible act. He didn't say anything like that. He didn't use those harsh words, that strong language, in talking about the two dead men. And so anger suddenly was taken off the table. Yeah. Politicians, of course, were talking about the police. Then suddenly it turned into this sentiment. Hand-holding, candlelight vigils. Yeah. Any picture of a black cop hugging a white cop was suddenly front and center.
Oh, yeah, Dallas
any
is
black protester shaking hands with a white person was suddenly the thing to get attention instead of the rage and the outrage at this this crime that happens on a daily basis.
Yeah, the Dallas police chief, for example, you know, he got more FaceTime than, you know, even than, what's his name, Braxton in New York City usually gets.
Yeah, he did, because he's a black man. And they it's not uncommon for major cities to have a black police chief, but it never seems to matter much in our, the death count of black people shot by the cops, killed by the cops in other ways. And so obviously, yes, he would get a lot of FaceTime. And the reason the corporate media do that is to dismiss and subdue any demand for justice. So you elevate this man who also, by the way, killed the killer. He and other police, I don't know if he
blew
made the
up.
Decision. The man suspected of shooting the police, his name was Micah Johnson, an Army reservist. The police, we don't know what happened to him. He was, we're told, talked to the police for 2 hours, and they sent in a bomb disposal unit, but attached a bomb to it and blew him up.
Right.
Yeah. And which was, you know, the Obama policy come home to the United States, yep. where the government says it has the right to kill people, drones, or blow them up, or without charge, without trial. And there's no recording of their conversation with this man. We don't know what he said, but we do know he was a veteran. He was he had been deployed in Afghanistan at one time, and his family say he came home a changed man, as they put it, suffering from depression or some other psychological problems, which is not surprising. That happens to veterans very often. So now we're left with the usual. The Obama administration has not prosecuted one killer cop, and it doesn't matter if the killing is done in secret or if this is in broad daylight or if there are cameras rolling, there is still no justice. And in these waning months of the Obama administration, we can expect more of the same. I've often said if we had a white president, at least one of these cops would have faced federal prosecution.
Right.
So we're people in you know, Minnesota and Louisiana in these two cases are going to have to hope for some local prosecution, although even when that does happen, as we saw here in New York with a Kai Gurley shot by a policeman in the stairwell of his apartment building, the cop was convicted and the black district attorney of Brooklyn lets the guy off with no jail time.
Right.
So that's also a reason for the rage, knowing that there will, in all probability, be no justice in either of these cases.
You know, and especially this particular DA in Brooklyn, who, you know, he had a lot of support from people on the left and from people in the black community. And this was his first real test, and he didn't seem any different from anybody else.
Yeah, it just goes to show you what the limits of these political office holders and who they're beholden to. Who knows what sort of deals were made or why he did it. He got credit. He deserved it for releasing people from prison,
right.
Who had been because of prosecutorial misconduct by his predecessor, people were serving very long prison sentences for murder, a crooked cop working with the DA's office. He freed those people. He seemed to be going in the right direction. And then when the real test came, he failed.
Mm-hmm.
So this is the 50th anniversary of the birth of the phrase Black Power. And it's important to talk about it because what sort of power do we have? And what that was, unfortunately, one of the ways that power was supposed to be manifested was people getting elected to office. But then they do and do what everybody else does. So this is the quandary that we're in now. And I was inspired to write this column because our anger is needed. The spectacle of President Obama and former President Bush at this huge memorial service for the five cops. Obama's never attended a memorial service or anything for a black victim of a police shooting ever. So, and aside from, he gave some perfunctory condolences to their families when he made his statement when he was in Europe for the NATO summit. But he pretty much, it was clear to me, didn't care. And he has this attitude whenever he has to talk about black people, where you can tell he doesn't really want to. He either seems dismissive and annoyed, or he parses his words very, very carefully so as not to make white people mad. And it's obvious that he, you know, as Kanye West said of George Bush after Hurricane Katrina, he just doesn't care about black people. We can say that about Obama.
You know, you can see that it's been developing what, you know, people have been calling it a movement, Black Lives Matter, or whatever
term you use to characterize it, registered trademark or not. You can see that as it's developing, almost you can see at the edges, almost into an uprising, that there's no real political outlet for it in the political structures. And it's rising at the same time that you had these masses of working class people rising up within the political structure behind Sanders and Trump. Now you see Sanders handing that over to Clinton, the antithesis of it. Mm-hmm. Trump sitting there sort of dumbfounded, not knowing what to do, although he made some interesting statement the day before yesterday or yesterday, the same day that Sanders endorsed Clinton, that in the context of saying law and order, which has the political connotations we both know, but in the context of that, bringing up, you know, I saw the video of the man that was killed in Louisiana and the man that was killed in Minnesota. It was very difficult to watch, very difficult to watch. And he was talking about that in the context of law and order as if the police were the ones violating law and order. He didn't say it. He didn't mortar it, but he laid the bricks out. And he's not going to draw the Black Lives Matter movement either. And so the working class movement behind Sanders is being tamped down. They're going to do whatever they can do to strip the working class movement behind Trump of any agency. And that leaves Black Lives Matter all by itself with no outlets in the political system. What next?
Well, Black Lives Matter, I have issues with Black Lives Matter, the organization. Not the idea that Black Lives right. matter and that Black people ought to protest our right to survive, basically. But the organization Black Lives Matter is problematic because they are very apolitical. They there is a complete absence of any political engagement in their activities. There's no talk of confronting political leadership. There are no demands made on political leadership. It seems to be a collective lament and a tool for protest. But they're very problematic, and that's not helpful to us at this juncture. We need a political organization to make demands. And Black Lives Matter, they had a conference last summer. And the programming, it was very strange. It was all about people's feelings, and it was all about healing, and all about safe spaces. And there were hardly any sessions, maybe one or two, that were political. So this group emerges. They coin this phrase, which has taken on a huge life of its own. Any Black person protesting is said to be from Black Lives Matter, whether right. they are or not. They have been attacked by people who are very racist, who will always attack Black people who say or do anything. Right. So they get this credibility that right. they don't deserve. So that when Rudy Giuliani or Rush Limbaugh attacks Black Lives Matter, they get this additional credibility without having right. actually done anything to change our situation. We don't have fewer police killings. We don't have more prosecution. We don't have anything except for attention, Black Lives Matter. So that's a big problem to have this this prominent organization, which frankly has not done anything. I have to be quite honest, and I've taken hits for saying that, but no. If anybody can tell me what they've done, I'd like for it to be pointed out to me.
Yeah, to the contrary.
Political
even.
Success.
Yeah, yeah. Just to the contrary, even, you know, the folks that were gathered for the emoting at the conference last year might well have instead been sitting down organizing some political actions. And so they're maybe not only ineffective, but effective at blunting a response.
Exactly. So I don't know what their real motivation is. I'm just looking at the results, or rather the lack of results in critiquing Black Lives Matter as an organization. So we have this this emotion that's out there without any political outlet. with no direction, with no instruction of what we need to do next. There are discussions about community control of the police. How would that work? That's something that Black Lives Matter were serious could assist in working on. But we have now essentially nothing. We have press attention while it lasts. Every time there's some video released, masses of people taking to the streets, but without any direction politically of what to do next, and an increase in repression. There was in Louisiana, where Alton Sterling was killed, protesters, the police invaded this woman. This woman invited protesters to be on her property. And the police, just with armored vehicle and riot gear, just invaded her home and invaded her property. The people have been arrested because of social media posts. So even while it's been ineffective, the system has decided that even thought and freedom of expression is going to be crushed. So for people to be arrested because of a Facebook post, for the cops to just barge into someone's home, is the fact that Michael Johnson was killed by police, the way he was killed, it just shows that even inconsequential activity is going to be crushed. And we don't have this political movement in place to fight against that, or even to name it and speak against it.
And the moment is pretty important as well. Professor Tony Montero says that there's a real possibility between now and November, even the election in November, that there's going to be another economic crisis. He marks the job creation in May. And assumes that the job creation numbers in June that were around 100,000 something is going to be downgraded again, like May was, to maybe 10 or 15,000, signaling perhaps an imminent economic catastrophe here in the United States. The elite is clearly nervous striking out in various ways over the apparent uprisings across the political spectrum. Again, Trump, Sanders, Black Lives Matter, all of that, and they have no solution to it. And so if the situation becomes critical, and that's what Professor Montero says, we may be looking at it going into, existential crisis. What exactly should people be doing to prepare for that, since, marching isn't going to solve any problems intrinsically?
Right. Well, I think politically, there needs to be a wholesale rejection of Hillary Clinton's campaign. I think it's important that people not vote for her. The Sanders voters are demoralized, although I have to point out to them, he said all along he would endorse Hillary Clinton if she got the nomination. I think it's very important that people reject her out of hand, that we lose this fear, especially in the Black community, of having to have a Democrat in the White House, especially with Obama's support and endorsement of her. It will make it more difficult for people to do that. But I think it's vital that Jill Stein get as many votes as she possibly can, and that people turn their backs on the Democrats. There has to be an active campaign to fracture the Democratic Party for good and to start the beginning of its demise. That will be critical. To support Hillary Clinton, to keep talking about whipping up hysteria about the dangers of Trump, who I believe is not going to win. We'll see what his fundraising numbers look like when they come out next week. But I believe he's struggling to raise money still. Republicans, or prominent Republicans, say they're not showing up at the convention. I think tells you the weakness of his campaign. He will get millions of votes. I don't doubt that. But I think she will get more. And this hysteria. I got a robocall the other day from Hillary Clinton's campaign. Donald Trump raised $2 million in the last 48 hours, which I doubt is true. But people, the first step is to begin the end of the Democratic Party. I think that is vital. And we're going to have to start speaking out against people like the Black Lives Matter organization who do not represent us and whose prominence is, in fact, a hindrance to us.
The instance of the shooting in Dallas, to me, invoked the concept of self-defense, forgetting the individual motive, the psychiatric mm-hmm. condition of the shooter, all the stuff that they talk about in the media. When a bunch of people that are similarly situated to myself are being killed, and I have military skills like a lot of folks in the Black community have, because that was the mm-hmm. only job available to a lot of people. Why are people shocked that you would have this response? And what kind of a response have you seen between the lines over the shooting back? That's how I term it.
Well, it's difficult. And this is the second time this has happened. There was a similar, very similar incident in New York City.
Right.
A man from Baltimore came to New York and shot two police as they sat in their patrol car yep. About a year ago. He also had a history of psychiatric problems. I think the people who actually do this will be people like that. The people who say to hell with it all are going to be people who are unstable or who don't have or don't think they have anything to lose. But this brings up our history of the Black Panther Party for self-defense. That was the full name of the organization, mm-hmm. but they were crushed, lest we forget. But yes, there's a concept of self-defense. And I think individually, I didn't sense much mourning from Black people about the death of the police. It definitely frightened white people. And it definitely sparked the let's do something, let's talk about unity, let's have a unity march, let's do a candlelight vigil. This fear of Black anger being manifested in the killing of these police officers. But we do, and there's the additional issue of gun rights for Black people. And it's very clear the NRA has said nothing to defend Philando Castile, who owned a gun legally and was killed yeah. because of it, because he revealed that he had a gun and the police shot him.
Right.
The Black people who died in open carry states because they were thought to have a gun, or in Ohio with toy guns, caused police to kill. So there's got to be a call for Black people to be able to defend themselves and to point out the hypocrisy of the NRA and others who claim they want no gun regulations and open carry and so forth, which clearly doesn't apply to Black people. But we have to shake off every time Obama says that we have unity and things aren't as bad as they were in the 60s, which he always refers to as being a terrible time, I find interesting, yeah. That we have to shake that off and say, yes, there is disunity, and this is why. It's because we're being killed. And first of all, just to state the facts as they are and not to be cowed by the politicians or the preachers or the people who are sent out to pacify us. Going back to my article, it's just why we need Black anger. We have to maintain that anger and thought so that we have a direction of our own that works for us. It's not handed to us, not even handed to us by an organization like Black Lives Matter, which allegedly works in our interest.
And that's all the news we have for you right now. For Community Public Radio, I'm Don DeBar in New York. Thanks for listening.